Idiots from Manila in the Philippines. How y'all doing? Coming up in a moment, Joshua Warren. You know, life is short. That's something the coroner, following my late wife's death, pounded into me. And boy, is he right about that. Life is short. And one of the things, no matter what your age is out there right now, no matter where you are listening, one of the very big things since the inception of Coast to Coast AM has been the discussion of ghosts. And it seems to me there would be no topic on a program of this sort, or really any other program, not that they all touch on it, or that many of them do, should cover that would be more important than ghosts. Because I guess we all want to know, is this it? Is this all there is? Or is there, in fact, something that follows? Do we really have an immortal soul that either goes onward or is manifested in some manner as a ghost here on Earth or whatever? So ghosts have been a fascination for me, well, always. And, of course, this year, as always, I will do a show on Halloween, Ghost to Ghost AM. Coming up in a moment, Joshua Warren wrote his first book at age 13. His first book at 13. Since then, he's had six more books, including Haunted Asheville, The Evil in Asheville, and his latest book, How to Hunt Ghosts. Joshua is the president of his multimedia productions company, Shadowbox Enterprises, LLC. He's also the founder and president of the Paranormal Research Team, LEMUR. That would be the League of Energy Materialization and Unexplained Phenomena Research. In addition, each January, Warren produces and hosts an interactive paranormal conference. So, in a moment, we'll talk about ghosts. The Evil in Asheville. Interesting. My mom is in Asheville, North Carolina, so certainly he would not have been writing about her. Joshua Warren, welcome to Coast AM, or back to, I should say.
Thank you, Art. It's certainly my pleasure.
Great to have you here. It was, I think, all the way back in 2001 we last spoke, correct?
That's right.
Okay. What's special about North Carolina? Why haunted Asheville? What's special about Asheville?
Well, you know, Asheville here in the western part of the state is in the middle of the Blue Ridge Mountains, and according to geologists, these are probably the oldest mountains in the entire world. So right off the bat, you have layer upon layer of history here. I mean, these mountains were once higher than the Rockies, and they've just been worn down to now the highest peak still east of the Mississippi is over 6,000 feet tall. And there's also something else quite peculiar about Asheville, because if you start here and you draw a line heading east, you pass through the Brown Mountain Range, where the mysterious Brown Mountain lights are seen, and then you hit an area called the Devil's Tramping Ground, this barren area where nothing at all has grown for many years, and there's stories about the devil sort of walking in circles and planning against mankind. And eventually, if you keep drawing that line east, you get to the coast, and that is where the first English settlement was set up in 1590, now known as the Lost Colony, because they all disappeared. And then that area on the coast is also known as the Graveyard of the Atlantic because of so many ships that have sunk there. And if you extend that line all the way out into the Atlantic, finally you hit the island of Bermuda, the top corner of the Bermuda Triangle. And so there's some mysterious alignment, apparently, that is between Asheville and so many other places where paranormal phenomena occur. And so I'm certainly lucky to be native here and have lived here my entire life.
Joshua, we have areas of the ocean that are completely devoid of life. And I think science is pretty well determined that the reason for that is most of the toxic chemicals that we're dumping into the Mississippi that ultimately go down into the Gulf and at least produce some of these areas that are devoid of life. But on land, I had not heard of such an area, and it would seem to me science would be very, very interested in what could possibly cause an area of no growth whatsoever. Have you, has anybody looked at that to try and understand why?
Well, I've never seen any really serious in-depth study, but at this point, I mean, the most likely sort of logical answer, if you want to use Occam's razor, is that at one point in time, there may have been some sort of a system in place where horses would walk in a circle around a mill, and there were traces of salt that were dissolved in that area for many, many years, and that maybe the salt there had prevented any long-term growth. But there's no proof that ever happened. Otherwise, I've only heard the people who have visited the site leave scratching their heads. And so we really don't have any idea why that this barren circle exists. And you can see why so many people think it may have something to do with a more spiritual or energy-like anomaly.
Perhaps so. Joshua, what is a ghost?
Well, according to my definition, and I produced this definition after looking at many, many others and trying to take into consideration everything, a ghost is some paranormal aspect of the physical form and or mental presence that appears to exist apart from the original physical form. Now, that may seem like a tedious definition, but it's certainly necessary to account for the broad spectrum of phenomena reported, and that word appears is especially significant because that shows that the experience of seeing a ghost is something that we cannot necessarily always differentiate from a subjective hallucination. And so I myself am, and I'm interested in looking at the subjective experiences, but I'm even more intrigued by seeing what relationship they might have to something in the external or objective environment.
All right. Is it your view that a ghost was once a living thing, whether it be an animal or a human being?
In some cases, certainly, but the problem with that is that we have ghosts of inanimate objects that are reported as well. I mean, you have ghost ships like the Flying Dutchman around the Cape of Good Hope, or we have the ghosts of stagecoaches as well as the horses that are pulling them. We have ghost cars, and so we certainly should never limit our idea of ghosts simply to something that was at one time living. And you find that some ghosts appear to be interactive, conscious, aware, unpredictable. Other ghosts seem just the opposite, very redundant, very predictable, non-aware, non-interactive, almost like an imprint being replayed, like a loop or some sort of an electromagnetic signature on a tape recording, say. And so these are two distinct, different types of ghosts, and yet when both manifest, we find the same types of signatures in the objective environment when, in fact, there is something that we can measure.
All right, now wait. The same type of signature. Now, whether it's an inanimate object or it was an apparently once living thing, you say you find the same kind of signatures. What kind of signatures are you talking about?
Well, I am especially intrigued by electrostatic charges that seem to build up at the time these things occur. And indeed, if I were only looking at the energy fields that I could measure, I, based upon that, could not directly tell you if it was living or non-living. And so it makes me, right off the bat, question the boundary between living things and non-living things. I mean, after all, we are all essentially composed of the same elements. But the electrostatic and the electromagnetic signatures are the ones that seem to be most prevalent and most reliable. For example, I can take electrostatic generators like a Wimshurst machine or a Van de Graaff machine and produce hundreds of thousands of volts, which are actually quite safe to experiment with because amperage is, you know, really where the
very low current, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you can use these charges, and we do it all the time in a laboratory, create not only three-dimensional light forms, but you can move objects at a distance without any physical connection. You can give a human the sensation of physical touch. You can give that person cold chills, make that person's hair stand on end. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can basically create all of these earmarks that we associate with a ghostly manifestation by utilizing electrostatic charges. And once an electrostatic charge moves, well, then it becomes an electromagnetic wave. And so you could pretty much say that electrostatic and electromagnetic are more or less different sides of the same type of thing. But
all right, it sounds like you've done a little on the technical side of this. So have you done actual investigation where you've gone into the field and measured an electrostatic charge in an area where there was some sort of manifestation going on at the time?
Yeah, time and time again, yes.
Time and time again?
Yes.
All right, what is it you use, Joshua, to measure this?
Well, you know, there is no such thing as a quote-unquote ghost meter, and so right off the bat, any reliable paranormal investigation team will take in every single tool that team can find in order to measure every aspect of the environment, because right off the bat, you have to know what the normal conditions are so you can weigh something paranormal or anomalous against it. But the things that I find react most frequently at areas where hauntings are occurring or something ghostly are simple electrostatic field meters. And once you get over 1,000 volts, and of course, this is a DC electrostatic charge, in an area where there is no object around and there is nothing that you can find changing in that environment, well, then you start seeing something interesting happen measuring that alone. Then you start looking at the electromagnetic changes. And, I mean, devices such as there's one I enjoy employing called a tri-field natural EM meter. It will show you when there are changes or shifts happening at a very, very small electrical scale. Or on a small electrical scale at a very tiny level. And those are the things that I enjoy employing most, and yet at the same time, there are tools that the average person can retrieve from his or her house and use for a very broad general investigation that will also yield some results to tell you if maybe it's worthy of further research.
For example?
Well, one of my favorite devices to actually measure electrostatic anomalies is a simple fluorescent bulb. You see, if you take a fluorescent bulb and you bring it into an area where there is a buildup of electrostatic charge, by simply holding this thing in your hand, it will start to glow and flicker.
Oh, now, that's absolutely correct, yes.
Yeah, now the ends should not be attached to anything at all, because all that matters is having a flow of charge going through the gas inside the bulb.
That's right.
You know, it takes a little bit more charge for this to happen than, of course, you could measure if you had one of these devices specifically geared for that purpose. But, you know, that's the best thing the average person can use. Aside from that, if you want to measure electromagnetic or magnetic anomalies, well, you know, a compass, of course, is always supposed to point north. If it doesn't point north or it starts spinning or doing something weird, well, there's probably a magnetic anomaly there. And you can also just turn on an AM radio to a blank frequency, and if there's some sort of electromagnetic interference, well, you're going to hear that on the band as well. And so I really do my best to try to look at different types of basic tools that are affordable and available to the average person that you can use to investigate these things, so that if you have enough there that makes you feel that it's worthy of further research, well, then you can decide to invest the extra money and learn even more about your phenomenon.
No, absolutely makes sense. A fluorescent bulb light would act exactly as you suggest. An AM radio would certainly indicate any interference going on in the area, so that would work. And what was the other?
A compass.
A compass, that's right. Of course, a compass. And that might even tell you the direction from which it's coming. How frequently have you been able to correlate these items acting in the manner you suggested with some sort of paranormal activity going on?
Well, over about the past 15 years, and I'm simply pulling this out of my head, I would say I've seen a clear correlation, according to my data, at least, probably 50 times, maybe something like that, which is fairly significant. I've been to between 500 and 1,000 supposedly haunted places over the years, but this activity is extremely rare. I mean, for example, after having been to so many places, and by the way, I don't just study ghostly phenomena. I look at, and my team, Lemur, looks at cases that are paranormal across the entire spectrum, because if you yourself define what you are looking for, then a lot of times you limit what people will report to you. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, after having investigated so many places, only once have I actually seen an apparitional form with my naked eyes. And I must tell you, honestly, despite having all the data there, if I had not seen one of these forms with my naked eyes, I still would have a lot more doubt about the reality of these phenomena, because it's just something that you have to experience for yourself. It's like all of these UFO videos. You can see the videos every day, you can see the pictures, but if you see something personally, it doesn't really set home with you.
I'm very well aware, Joshua. I, of course, have seen my own UFO close up, you know, close encounter of the real close kind, and you're absolutely correct. Well, on the other hand, I've never seen a ghost. Now, I wonder if you've looked into other aspects of your research. For example, as you know, I interview these folks who do EVP research. Have you looked into that very far?
Yes, and, you know, I have a sort of strange and complex fascination with EVP, and I'll tell you why. If we were ever able to create a device that is literally like a telephone to the other side, which is sort of ultimately what EVP is all about, well, then we wouldn't need any of these other tools. I mean, all this warehouse of technology that my team and I have built up over the years, and we lug around in caravans of cars, would be unnecessary, because we'd be cutting straight to the chase. We'd be able to talk to people on the other side. And so, therefore, this goal of having that communication device is a paramount ideal. On the other hand,
wait a minute. Let's qualify this a little bit, Joshua. The folks that I have on the air here do, for the most part, blind recording, and they get voices that are apparently from the other side. I firmly actually believe they are from the other side. Now, George Meeks and others were doing some experiments that involved what you were just talking about, kind of a telephone to the other side. In other words, ongoing contemporary, right now, two-way communication with somebody on the other side. Meeks was doing that, and I wish somebody else would pick up on that work. But even the work that's being done by my two friends in Utah from GIS is compelling work, very, very compelling. I can't imagine where else these voices are coming from. Can you?
Well, you know, and ironically, by the way, George Meek is from Franklin, North Carolina, about an hour and a half down the road from me here.
There you go.
So, yeah, it goes back to the possible connection to the location. I've never seen any body of work, of EVP work, that is comprehensive and accurate enough to stand up to the scrutiny of the scientific method. Now, that is not to say that these folks are not indeed communicating with the other side. But as you know, one of the frustrating things about scientific research is you must have repeatability. You
right.
must be able to adapt something to a controlled situation in a laboratory, and you must be able to tell other people, here's how to do this, and they should mm-hmm. be able to go out and reproduce it.
With EVP, Joshua, they can do that. Not that it can be repeated on absolute demand, But I've had countless numbers of people after programs that we've done of the GIS go out with recorders themselves and inevitably, or more times than not, come back with an EVP. Not that they can get it on demand, but they usually come back with one, Joshua.
Well, I've gotten EVP as well. You know, I have gotten voices as well, but you have to have that on-demand factor. You see, that's the problem. You are a perfectly living physical person, and still, I might call you 100 times, and you only pick up the phone once or twice, and you aren't a ghost. So how difficult is it to call somebody on the other side and get them to pick up enough to give us a reliable sort of or a reliable ratio of feedback? So that's the problem. You see, if EVP were something that would eventually lead us in the direction of getting that reliable communication, it is the most important thing we could utilize.
But Joshua, hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll come back to EVP. We've got a break here at the bottom of the hour from the Philippines. Manila, I'm Art Bell. That's fact. Hello there from rainy Manila in the Philippines, Southeast Asia. My guest is Joshua Warren. We're talking about ghosts. We're talking about, and this is the first time we've done that, really. Inanimate objects as well as objects that, what you know, at one time were animated. That's very interesting because as I think about it, the things Joshua named were at one time pretty much connected with human beings, right? Ghost ships, that sort of thing. They were one time connected with things that were, well, people that were living. So I wonder if inanimate objects actually have the ability to reappear or hang in the ether as things that once had a soul do, or they simply reappear because they were part of many lives. I don't know. Something we'll think about. Joshua Warren, back in just a moment. Okay, we'll talk a little more about EVP, but I do want to touch on that. Joshua, I'm really interested. The inanimate objects you spoke about, it did occur to me that you're right. I mean, there are ghost ships, there are ghost planes, there are, you know, there's this and that, things that appear and disappear that people see. But these are things that at one time or another were pretty much all connected to living human beings. Isn't that true?
The most prominent examples are, however, the funny thing and the tricky thing about that question is that the data that we have for the most part about ghostly phenomena, I guess you could say maybe altogether, is based upon human observation. Mm-hmm. And so you're talking about places where humans usually are in order for these things to be observed. But in some cases it goes... it might be pushing it because we do have things like time slips, as we call them, where someone actually turns around in an old house and sees that entire house the way it was 100 years before renovations, and everything, and the whole environment looks different. Now, still, like you said, I mean, there is a connection to humans because we're basing it on a human observation. So it's almost like the... I guess the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, the idea that you can't truly measure something in its basic essence because that the very fact that you are observing it changes what is being observed. And so that's why this is so very complex, because that you have to place ghostly experiences and ghostly encounters in context based upon the observer's position to get a full round scope of the experience, whereas even though we may have all this other data we can apply, data in and of itself doesn't really tell you necessarily anything about what's happening if you don't have the human observer there to interpret it.
Okay. Joshua, I want to ask you about something. This is probably, I don't know, I might have discussed this before, but I don't think so. It's been very hard for me to talk about. After my wife passed in January, I went through a period of time, very, very close in. I'm talking about the first few days after she passed, Joshua. I'm normally a guy who likes the house nice and cool. I will turn the air conditioners down, and I just love it cool. That's just the way I am. I've always been that way, and I guess I always will be that way. However, in the first several days after my wife passed, I was absolutely freezing, Joshua. I mean, I was freezing. So I turned the air conditioning up. It got up to around 80 degrees in the house, and that's just unheard of for me. I keep it at about 68 or better. And it got up to about 80 degrees, and I was still, Joshua, I'm telling you, I was so freezing cold. My teeth were chattering. I could feel it in every bone and sinew of my body. It got so damn cold that I had to go into the shower, turn the shower on hot, and just, I literally sat in the shower and let the hot water beat on me, and it didn't get better for about 30 minutes. It was the doggondest thing I ever felt in my whole life. She was there, or somebody was there, and I'm convinced it was her, Joshua. Have you heard reports? I know there are many reports of cold associated with some sort of presence. What can you tell me?
Well, right off the bat, that makes me feel that there's a good chance that not only Ramona may have been there, but she may have actually been trying very hard to manifest. And the reason I say that is because we have gone to so many of these places that are haunted, where these cold spots float around, and we all kinds of temperature gauges, and we don't find any significant measurement to show us that there actually is a drop in the external temperature. However, you can feel it. And so that's why we went into the laboratory and we started doing experiments with what we call an ion wind. And when you have a flow of electrostatic charges moving across your flesh, I mean, it can absolutely freeze you. It feels icy cold. You wouldn't know the difference if I took, you know, a canister of compressed air and blew it across you. And we find that when there is intense movement of electrostatic charges, you get that ion wind that makes you feel cold. Now, there is no actual drop in temperature, so that's the funny thing about it. You can measure the electron or the electrostatic flow.
Oh, no, I can tell you for a fact. I mean, I actually watched the temperature go up to 80 degrees, and I was still, there was no relief for it. I was freezing cold, you know, teeth chattering cold, that kind of cold, and it was up to 80 degrees. So you're absolutely correct. I could look at the thermometer, and I could tell it had reached 80, and I was still freezing. Now, this happened on like 2 or 3 days in succession, very close to her passing. So there was something, absolutely was something going on. Now, I can't rule out the fact that it was in my mind, but I'm telling you, it was as real as anything else in my life, as real as the desk I'm touching here, banging on. So,
yeah, and that's the funny thing about it. When it comes to something like the feel of a room or something like the smell, I mean, how often do you hear about someone saying, I smell a cigar or I smell a flower? You know, we don't have a meter right now that we can walk into a room with and measure a smell.
Right.
And yet, it's a real thing. It's a tangible thing that makes an impact. It makes certain neurons fire off in our brains. And that's the thing about ghostly phenomena at this point. It makes us beg this question of what is the boundary of reality compared to ourselves and our technology. And the fact of the matter is, we ourselves, as humans, are meters, so to speak, ourselves. The problem is calibrating the meter. You know, what do you calibrate the meter by? But when you say that you have this feeling of cold, I feel like that there was probably a flow of electrostatic charges causing this, considering there was no other explanation that you could document. And that is a classic sign of someone who is trying very much to manifest. And I wonder, did you ever ask her if she would come back?
I talk to her constantly. I don't think I ever made a specific request for her to come back. No, I still talk to her. And anyway, I just wanted to pass that on to you that that was as real as can be. I've never, ever felt anything like it in my life. There was no relief for it, save jumping in a hot shower. And even then, the relief didn't come for about 30 minutes. So it was just amazing. And I, you know, in movies that you see about ghostly phenomena, they always show, in fact, they go to the degree of showing as though it were below 32 degrees and you can see the person's breath and that sort of thing. But you're saying that is not the way it really happens.
Not based upon the data that I've been able to personally collect.
All right. All right. Let's talk for a moment about, you've apparently written a brand new book. You've got a new book called Pet Ghosts. Is that right?
Yes, Pet Ghost, Animal Encounters from Beyond the Grave, and right off the bat, I think that the title may sort of limit the perception of what the book is about, because it's not just about cats and dogs and stories along those lines. I mean, this is really a book about non-human apparitions altogether, and looking at what is this potential border between humans and other creatures, and even exploring the fringes, looking at, say, Bigfoot or Mothman or the Loch Ness Monster, and examining them. Are those things animals, or are they something of a semi-physical nature? And so, yeah, Pet Ghost is really a book about non-human apparitions.
Non-human apparitions. All right. Well, let's actually, though, touch on the pet part of it for a moment, because I just cannot tell you how many emails I've had from people who tell me that their dog or their cat absolutely has been back. They felt them on the bed with them. They felt the little paws going across the bed. They've seen things disturbed in the house that that pet loved before. So how common?
Well, it's extremely common. You know, I didn't even realize myself how common it was until I started actively seeking it, because people look rather flippantly upon animals altogether. And there are a lot of complexities when it comes to the subject matter. I mean, for example, if you're outside and you see an animal or running around or a bird flying through the trees, in many cases, you have no way of differentiating between this creature being a physical, tangible organism and something else. Oftentimes, animal ghosts, or as I call them, phantomals, they look just as physical as living creatures. But, you know, one thing I find intriguing about this subject is that usually when an animal ghost comes back, it's for a limited period of time. I mean, maybe a week to a few weeks. And in fact, there were hundreds of stories that I didn't include for Pet Ghosts simply because it was that basic. I mean, well, you know, I hear my dog whining or I feel a brush on the leg, but there wasn't a real story there, so to speak. In other cases, however, you have places where there seems to be this really special connection between the environment and the animal, and it allows that creature to come back again and again. And those are the places where we even have stuff like dinosaur ghosts being reported. Huh.
Now, there's a new one. Is it your belief, Joshua, that animals have a greater propensity to come back from the other side than do humans?
I don't think there's anything greater about it. I think it's about equal. And, you know, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, looking at the connection between animate and inanimate objects and their relationship to ghosts. You know, I'm criticized sometimes by people of faith who say, well, you know, only humans have souls and animals don't.
Yeah, I know.
And for you to make that claim is an insult to humans. And I say, well, you know, when you look at humans and animals under the microscope, I mean, at the smallest levels, there is nothing really there that you can use to tell the difference between us.
Not as far as I'm concerned, Joshua. If you live with an animal, inside dog or, in my case, inside cats, and you look at every aspect of that animal, there is nothing, in my opinion, that separates them and us, other than the ability to vocally communicate. Everything else, jealousy, anger, happiness, depression, playfulness, even self-awareness, curiosity. I could go on and on and on and on with a list, but the people who live with pets know that I'm right. They have all of these things. So other than the ability to vocalize, as far as I'm concerned, my cats and dogs and probably other mammals have souls. Now, that's going to engender a lot of criticism, as you mentioned, because, well, it's not supposed to be. We're supposed to be the only ones with souls. But I don't believe that, Joshua.
Well, and even beyond that, it's not even necessary to have a soul to be a ghost. So, I mean, you could say that issue of having a soul or a spirit is even irrelevant altogether. But if you want to look at it that way, then yes, there is no difference between us and them at that level. And I mean, both of us are primarily empty space and water to start with. And then beyond that, you know, we're just a loose mixture of these other elements that we share in common with inanimate objects. And so, I agree with you entirely on that point that the people or the reason people find such a connection with their animals is that because, you know, we are so similar to them, and the only difference that we have between them may be no different than what we see with humans in many cases. I mean, there are people out there who are in a state where they cannot speak or they can't relate to us, say someone who's on a life support machine. Does that mean this person is any less human than we are? No. I mean, that we are all essentially made of the same substance, and what I found is that there is no reason to believe that animals are any different in terms of their propensity to come back from the other side, so to speak.
Do you see any difference, Joshua, between what we call a ghost, whether it be that of a human or an animal, and what human beings regard as alien spirits or alien creatures, are they the same sort of thing?
Well, you know, that is a question that I have learned so much more about answering just since last fall, because last fall, I went to Roswell for a week and did research there for a program the Discovery Channel was planning to air, which oddly enough is in the can, and yet they have decided not to air it, even though we had some amazing stuff captured.
Why are they not going to air it?
They have not given any sort of specific explanation for why they won't air it. And in fact, months ago, Jim Mars, who also was involved with the project, brought it up on Coast to Coast when George Norrie was on, and many, many people contacted Discovery and were demanding to see this thing, and it's sort of mysterious why they will not air it, because, you know, I have done so much research, I've seen so many images of paranormal phenomena, and we captured something on 7 or 8 high-definition cameras in Roswell that I have never seen in my entire life. The program was called X-Ops, and assuming that you're never going to see this, I may as well go ahead and tell you what it looked like.
Yes, by all means, because perhaps it will tell us what it is they were afraid to air.
We were at Hangar 84, which is where, according to, you know, popular lore, the bodies were brought after the crash. And one thing that I should mention is that when we went to Roswell, we weren't just going there to do the same old story about the alien crash and the people who had seen this and that. No, the new twist was that now people in Roswell are actually seeing the ghosts of the aliens. And I mean, I'm not talking one or two people out there you might find a little wacko. I mean, these are some quite reliable people who have a great deal of credibility, people in the medical profession in particular, who are working at the area that used to be the old Roswell Army Airfield Hospital, who have been seeing the apparitions of the aliens. And so,
all right, and so what exactly did you capture on? Did you say 7 or 8 high-def cameras?
There were 7 or 8 high-def cameras there, and I don't know how many of them captured this, but I assume they all must have. At one point, we did a seance in Hangar 84. Now, I personally am not big on seances. I was just there with my equipment to document what happened, but there were a couple of psychics on the team, and those people led the seance. And at one point in the middle of the session, and I mean this was a dark, cold, windy night in Roswell, what appears to be what I can best describe as a huge snake-like figure appears over our heads and slithers across Hangar 84.
And they caught this on camera? They caught this on camera and they're not airing it?
High-definition camera from multiple angles. Now, you explain that to me. I mean,
oh, no, there's no way to explain that.
That is, it's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life.
Unless they were, unless they thought they were being bamboozled somehow or another.
Well, I, you know, we all saw that. We said, "Wow, we have hit the jackpot!" You know, we came here and actually got something that is so compelling. I mean, this is going to be a
fun well, all right. The producer, who was there along with the cameraman and all the rest of it, they must have had some comment about what was caught on camera, right? They must have gone, "Oh my God, look at this!"
Oh, yeah, they were just ecstatic. I mean, it really was that point where to me, it was a distinct point, and I think for them it was the distinct point where this crossed over from being another prospective program to this is a classic show. We have
all right, Joshua, hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. It sounds like they caught the smoking snake, so to speak, and in Roswell. Can't beat that. From Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell.